Thank you so much, Dr. Arnold, Lauren, Tesha, Holly, just everyone, Dr. Bauer, who have been so gracious. I'm honored to be here and really blessed to be able to join you in worship this morning and in this way. It's been very, very special. Thank you, choir, and it's just been wonderful. O love that will not let me go, I rest my weary soul in thee. I give thee back the life I owe, that in thine ocean depths its flow may richer, fuller be. O light that followest all my way, I yield my flickering torch to thee. My heart restores its borrowed ray, that in thy sunshine's blaze its day may brighter, fairer be. O joy that seekest me through pain, I cannot close my heart to thee. I trace the rainbow through the rain and feel the promise is not vain that morn shall tearless be. These are the first three verses that George Matheson wrote. An important piece, O Love That Will Not Let Me Go. He was born in 1842 in Glasgow, Scotland, and felt called by God to prepare for ministry there. At the age of 20, as he was doing just that, he was engaged to be married. He was diagnosed with an eye disease that would leave him blind within a few short months. His fiancée left him, unable to deal with this. And so where was he to go? What was he to do? And yet he did not give that up. His sister came into the picture in a wonderful way. She attended divinity school for him, took notes and tutored and taught him what he needed to learn. And he became a great preacher throughout Scotland in the years after that, winding up in Edinburgh, one of the great churches there. At the age of 40, when he was 40, his sister was engaged and was actually to be married. And he realized that everything, the dynamics, would change so much. And on the night before her wedding, he wrote this song. He would say later that it came to him within 5 minutes. He himself was a poet and had done and had published various poems in his lifetime, but this one was the only one that flowed with no change. That's true, by the way, also of the person when she composed the music. It has a special importance, but it begins with that choice that Matheson would make of the love that would not let him go, and in response to that, to follow him and to choose the best. Well, we go back even earlier to Naaman, and this fellow, we learn, he's a very influential and important man. The word there is the same as describes the important woman a chapter before, who is the Shunammite, who prepares a place for Elisha the prophet to stay as he passes by again and again. But Naaman was a general in the Syrian army, the enemy of Israel at this time. But he's a great man, but he had a skin disease. The translations will render it leprosy. I'm not sure that Hansen's disease was so in existence in the Middle East at this time, before Alexander the Great, but it was some sort of skin disease. In Israel, among those who observed the law, this would render him unclean, partly at least because the disease would create your skin and make it look like it was that of a corpse, white and dead. I don't know what it was like for Naaman, if something like that prevailed in Damascus, but I do know that it was not helpful for him, and it was something that he longed to be rid of. Well, the Aramaeans were not the nicest of people. Sometimes they raided, and they raided into Israel. And as they did, they had with them, or took with them, a young girl that they captured, along with no doubt others, who they then trafficked, as was common certainly in that day. This girl wound up as a slave to the wife of Naaman. And in that position, you can imagine her situation. It may have been good, it may have been bad, I don't know, but she certainly was in a situation where she had the right to be angry with God for what he had allowed. And the last thing that a person like that, feeling victimized, would want would be to help their master. But that was not the case with this believer. For so she believed in the God of Israel and the God of Elisha that she would, in fact, recommend to her mistress and to Naaman then to seek out his help, that he could help her. And in that move, in that gesture, so brief in the description that we have here, there is the power of someone who gives themselves to God and who is willing to go out of their way to go even beyond expectation. And so she sets Naaman on his course to healing and ultimately to faith. He goes to the king of Damascus, who's more than happy to send him to do whatever to see him healed, because this must have been one of his most important assets militarily. And so he takes this letter to the king of Israel, probably Joram at this time, and comes before the king and reads this letter. And the king, it may not have been quite written as elegantly as one might wish, but the king just reads in it what he wants to. And he says, what is going on here? The king of Damascus is just looking to find a pretext for war with me. Am I God that I can heal? Well, of course not. But it is such a strange reaction in so many ways. I mean, after all, the major military leader is standing in front of him. He really has power over him at that moment. Why would he act in such a way? And surely Joram knew of the miracles that the prophet Elisha had done, how he had provided for the widow who was starving with her child oil in jar after jar after jar, how he provided a multiplication of loaves for the company of prophets, how he had raised the Shunammite's son from the dead, how in one thing after another he had provided life and hope and health. But Joram did not think of that. That was not his mind or his disposition. Sometimes maybe it helps us as we come and worship in this way to think of our God and who he is and what he can do for us. Anyway, Joram's busy tearing his robes in anger, and Elisha sends him a message. Now, we don't know how he found out about it, but we do know that Elisha knew a lot. And in the next chapter, he winds up with all kinds of information about the king of Damascus and passing it on to Joram. Well, in this case, he says, no, send this guy to me that he may know that there is a prophet in Israel. What a wonderful statement. But think about that statement. Elisha didn't say, send this guy to me so that I can heal him or God can heal him. The ultimate purpose of what Elisha was doing and called to do wasn't physical healing. That certainly could play into it and did here. But the ultimate purpose was faith, that he could bring Naaman to faith, as happened. Well, Naaman shows up at Elisha's door with all his horses and chariots. It must have been quite a magnificent display and huge amounts of wealth. And surely at this point, Elisha would come out and honor him. Well, he didn't. He just sent a messenger out. Wrong move if you're trying to impress a Naaman. But out comes the messenger and says, go and dip yourself 7 times in the Jordan River and you'll be healed. Well, Naaman hears this and he's kind of angry because he's been around a bit, I mean, in his army, in his leadership, and in everything. He knows what prophets do. They expect a lot of money for healing, so he brought that. And then they also will put their hands over you, do some hocus pocus, and out of that, you'll be healed, I'll be fine. But this guy didn't do that. Now he wants me to go and dip in the jar. Of all the places, I got clean water in Damascus I could go in if I needed to dip. And he goes off in a huff, angry. And if it ended there, it would have been shortcut. But again, we read there are servants who intervene, like the servant girl, the slave girl in Damascus. Now, I don't know whether these servants are in fact slaves themselves, or whether as sometimes servants of the king were officials, but they were subordinate to him. And they come up to him and they say, oh, you know, if the prophet had asked you to do some great labor, you would have done it. Be out there doing it. He's just asking you to go and dip yourself in the Jordan River. Yeah, maybe it'd be worthwhile. And so, again, through God's work, sometimes where you least expect it, there he convinces him. Well, off goes Naaman to the Jordan River. Now, you can imagine as he's going into the river, he's got to take off all of his accoutrements, his weapons, his special dress, and everything else. And he goes in just like anyone else would go into the Jordan River. And indeed, in what could well be understood as a kind of humble state. This is just like, in fact, at the Day of Atonement, the priest divests himself, takes all of his vestments off, and goes through the water, and then puts on simple linen garments as he comes before God as a penitent. And so does Naaman. I don't know how much he realized it at that moment, but he dips 7 times. It says on the 7th time he came up, and his skin was like that of a young boy. This is exactly the same words and language, na'ar katon, as the young slave girl, na'ar katana. And we see here the way in which the slave girl, by her actions of faith before God, had set him on the way where he would become like her as a believer. And as one, certainly, who had nice skin, I guess, but that wasn't the end of the story. That was just a symbol. So he goes back, now very excited, and he comes back to Elisha's home. And there's Elisha, not on the other side of the door, but right standing in front of him, because now there's no difference. There's no separation between Elisha and Naaman. Not because Elisha's changed, but because Naaman has changed, because he has become a believer. And so that there's no doubt to that, he makes this great confession. It's interesting how in this fairly long story, and appreciate the time spent reading it, this is sort of right in the middle. You have how Naaman changes and his confession takes place. It's not quite Romans 10:9 that if you believe you and confess in your heart that Jesus is Lord and God has raised him from the dead, you will be saved. But it's a correspondent in the Old Testament that there is no God in Israel, no God in all the world except in Israel. Quite a confession. In fact, it's amazing. It's in some ways the most profound monotheistic statement that you have, certainly in the Old Testament and even in the New. You can't get much more monotheistic. That phrase, no God, is also interesting because the same phrase was used back in 2 Kings 1, just a few chapters earlier, where it described how another king of Israel had fallen through some lattice work in his palace and was dying because of an injury he acquired. So he sent off to see whether there might be a God to heal him and to help him. But he didn't send to Elijah then, or to the God of Israel. He sent to Baalzebub, the God of the Philistines. And it was on the way the messengers were going that Elijah intervenes and stops and says, "Is there no God in Israel?" Because this was the problem. The king didn't believe that. Whereas now Naaman believes there is no God in the rest of the world, except in Israel. And so those who should believe don't. And those who don't believe now come to belief and come to faith. And so there is this marvelous transformation. And Naaman says, "So what do you want? Just take whatever I brought, all these hundreds and hundreds of pounds of gold and silver and changes of garment. They're all for you." Elisha says, "No, as the Lord lives, I will not take anything from you." Naaman wasn't perfect in his knowledge, but he sure knew a lot. But yet, this wasn't the time for Elisha to take goods and gifts and money. God would provide that. He had just confessed that God was in control and could provide what he needed. He didn't need that. And he didn't want Naaman to sense that that was part of a deal here. He was doing this because it was ministry, and he wasn't doing it ultimately, Elisha. It was God who was working to do it. And he wanted him to know that, even as he had confessed it. And everything in that confession, I believe, now proceeds in terms of what Naaman does. Elisha refuses that. Naaman says, "Well, let me take some bags of dirt, sacks of dirt, so that I can go back," because he knew that the God of Israel would be worshipped and the altars and sacrifices would be given in Israel. Therefore, if Naaman were to sacrifice and worship this God as he would now and only this God, he wanted to do it with the earth of the Holy Land and build the altar on that. And so Elisha allows him to take that. I guess she really couldn't say no. It's everywhere, the land. But the point is, that's part of what he wants to give to him. And then he turns and says this very controversial thing. He says, "Oh, you know, I'm with my master, the king, and once in a while we go in, he has to go in, he wants to go into the temple of Ramon, this god there in Damascus, and bow down before him. Now, I have to bow down because I have to help him, and I have to help him get up. Please forgive your master, your servant, for doing this." And it's an interesting request of all the requests. I know one of your students, I don't know, Jeremy Chu, wrote an article on this very topic in the Asbury Journal, where he said, I think it's, the title is, "I am bowing on the outside, but standing on the inside," and trying to deal with this. But if you understand what's going on here, Naaman is saying, "No, I'm not worshiping him. I've just got done confessing, and now I'm taking and I'm planning to worship and sacrifice only to the God of Israel. And so whatever else, this is my grappling with the controversies and issues that I personally have to deal with. But know that I shall confess no other God." And I believe that's why Elisha responds as he does. I say, "Well, Elisha doesn't say yes." Well, good reason for that. There is no word for yes in biblical Hebrew. So he's not going to say that. The way you affirm something in biblical Hebrew is by repeating it, possibly some other ways as well. But what he says is, "Lech l'shalom," go in peace, in shalom. It's not something you say if you're disagreeing with the person or angry at them. It is a blessing, and there they leave it. And Naaman in his faith goes back. But there's an story, doesn't end there. There's the other servant, Gehazi. Gehazi interesting guy. You know, he's there watching all this, and he says, well, Naaman really got off too cheap. He shouldn't have been able to do that. No. We gotta get something from him. And of course, for Gehazi, it's all a question of greed. So he follows after in his greediness. He follows after Naaman, and he comes to him and says, you know, can we, and he tells him this story about others who have come, and Naaman, he doesn't know, but it sounds like he can contribute to the ministry of Elisha. So why wouldn't he be eager? And he says, yes, take what you asked for, and I'll give you double the money you've asked for. That'd be great. And so Naaman continues in this attitude, the attitude of God, the attitude of his servants, the attitude of generosity, of magnanimity, giving above and beyond that which is expected. Whereas Gehazi is kind of just the opposite. He continues in the attitude of greed, getting above and beyond what he expected. So he takes the money back, puts it in his house, shows up before Elisha. Elisha says, where have you been? He says, just been around the area here. And of course, Elisha knows more than I think. Gosh, didn't Gehazi realize you can't really fool this guy? So Elisha says, I saw you. You know, God enabled me. I saw you in my mind's eye. I saw exactly what you did. Twice Gehazi lied. The second time when Elisha asked him point blank, he had the opportunity to confess. He had the opportunity even then to say, I'm sorry. I really messed up. But he didn't. And so he stands before Elisha and before God condemned and says the skin disease that came upon Naaman and left him now will come upon you. And so Elisha has this skin disease for the rest of his life and his descendants. And you get this contrast of individuals here and how they respond to what is God's best. But I think one of the greatest contrasts is between the slave girl at the beginning and Gehazi. They're both servants, but the slave girl is in a foreign country. She's vulnerable. She's removed from the community of God and dependent only on her faith. Whereas Gehazi's in the middle of the community. He's living day to day with a prophet who does miracle after miracle. What does he not see? The slave girl nevertheless remains faithful and speaks truly of God's work through the prophet. Whereas Gehazi just seems to be focused on this material wealth and speaks falsely to conceal his greed. I mean, there's all kinds of practical applications here for people who want to go into ministry, isn't there? And the question of what kind of ministry do we want and why are we here and doing this? Is it because God called us? Is it because of ministry? Is it because of the needs of the world and the message of the gospel? Or is it because what we can get out of it after all? Well, slave girl succeeds for Naaman. Gehazi fails. He loses the health that he had. But like Naaman, there is the possibility and hope for faith for any and all, no matter where they come from, even the enemies of the people of God. But even the closest to God, like Gehazi, cannot presume upon that association. The call to faith and faithfulness is lifelong. And I think, like George Matheson, are we able to see with faith that all is possible. O cross that liftest up my head, I dare not ask to fly from thee. I lay in dust life's glory dead, and from the ground there blossoms red, 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 what Matheson could no longer see but hope for. There blossoms red life that shall endless be. Amen.